This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, a new opera about the atomic bomb. But first, back in the 1940s, the microbiologist Selman Waksman discovered streptomycin, the first effective antibiotic against tuberculosis. He went on to win the Nobel Prize for his discovery. But today, almost every bacterial infectious disease has a drug-resistant strain, including tuberculosis. And to find new antibiotics to fight these drug-resistant strains, scientists are turning back to soil samples where streptomycin and many other antibiotics were found. And they've had some very successful luck in identifying new antibiotic compounds and figuring out how they work. Some of these may even help the fight against drug-resistant tuberculosis today. Joining me now to talk about that research out today in the journal Cell is my guest, Richard E. Bright, investigator for the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He's also a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Rutgers University and laboratory director at the Waksman Institute of Microbiology there in Piscataway, New Jersey. He joins us from New Jersey. Welcome to the program, Dr. E. Bright.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Tell us about these antibiotic compounds. They come from the soil.
That's correct. We studied three compounds. The three compounds were identified by our German collaborators, Rolf Janssen and Herbert Irschick, by screening soil samples. They screened soil samples for microbes that produce antibiotic compounds, compounds that are effective against other microbes in the soil environment. Mm-hmm. Microbes produce these antibiotic compounds as part of their competition for scarce nutrients in the hostile, nutrient-poor environment of soil. Scientists are able to exploit this by identifying microbes that produce such compounds, isolating, characterizing, and developing further such compounds.
So the bacteria are fighting each other in the soil?
Correct.
And it's a survival of the fittest bacteria, and they put out these poisons. They try to poison one another.
Correct.
And you find those antibiotics. Are these new bacteria? Are these new antibiotics, or have we known about them before?
Our collaborators, our German collaborators, identified the three compounds we analyzed nearly two decades ago. So they've been known, and they have antibiotic activity, but they're not ready in their initial form for the clinic. In order to bring them to the clinic, their potency has to be optimized. They have to be made more potent. Their pharmacological properties have to be optimized. Mm-hmm. In order to do that in a rational and informed way, one needs first to define their target, their mechanism of action, and the structural basis of their mechanism of action. And that is what we have now done.
And what makes them unique in that sense?
What is special about these is that their target, their biological target inside a bacterial cell, is the molecular machine that the bacterium uses to carry out its first step in gene expression. In this step in gene expression, the genetic information that's stored in DNA is read out and synthesized as a copy in RNA. The molecular machine that carries out this critical first step in gene expression is called RNA polymerase. It's a protein machine. It is a large protein machine. It has dimensions on the nanometer scale and has multiple moving parts. The importance of this target in terms of antibacterial therapy and anti-tuberculosis therapy is that this machine is essential for survival of a bacterial cell. If one inhibits this machine, a bacterial cell dies. This is a proved target for broad-spectrum antibacterial activity. That means antibacterial activity against many different species of pathogens. It's a proved target for broad-spectrum activity because all species of bacterial pathogens have this machine, and they have versions of this machine that are sufficiently similar that drugs that target the machine from one species of pathogen also are successful in targeting the machine from other species of pathogen.
So you're basically targeting that machine inside.
Correct.
You're like throwing a monkey wrench into it.
Correct. And, again, it has been approved target for broad-spectrum antibacterial therapy, but in particular, it is a uniquely important, critical target for anti-tuberculosis therapy.
Uh-huh.
The reason for that is that in a patient with active tuberculosis infection, there are both rapidly growing tuberculosis bacteria and slow-growing tuberculosis bacteria. The slow-growing bacteria are called persisters. Mm-hmm. In order to clear the infection and cure the patient, one needs to kill both types of tuberculosis bacteria, the rapidly growing ones and the persisters. In the persisters, there are very few biochemical activities occurring in the persister cells, and as a result, there are very few points of vulnerability. There are very few ways that a drug can interfere with survival of a persister. There is one clearly known proved target to kill a persister, and that target is the machine that we've been studying, bacterial RNA polymerase. Mm-hmm. The persisters need RNA polymerase to survive. If one interferes with the activity of RNA polymerase in the persister dies. As a result, this enzyme, this machine, bacterial RNA polymerase, is a uniquely important target for anti-tuberculosis.
Now I'm trying to visualize a real machine here. Give me an analog of what actually in that machine are you aiming for?
So this is a machine with moving parts. Perhaps the simplest way to envision this machine is to imagine a crab's claw. This machine has a shape reminiscent of a crab claw with two prominent pincer-like projections and a cleft between them. When this machine functions, it must grab onto DNA, just like a claw grabs onto an object, grabs onto food, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. To do that, the claw must open to be able to bind DNA and then must close to be able to hold onto DNA. This opening and closing occurs by a swinging motion of one of the two pincers of the claw about a hinge at its base. What we have found is that these three compounds function by binding to that hinge and jamming it. They jam it in a closed state so that the claw can't open to bind DNA. Since it can't open to bind DNA, the machine can't function, bacteria can't live.
So it's like putting one of those rubber bands around the lobster claws we see.
In a way, that would be a way to describe it. Putting gum in a hinge would be another way to describe it. Putting sand in a hinge would be another way to describe it.
Mm-hmm. But would these bacteria not find another way to mutate and get around this sort of mechanism?
For any bacterial compound, resistance ultimately is inevitable. Bacteria are able to mutate to overcome this attack. They are able to develop resistance to these mm-hmm. agents. What needs to be done, therefore, is to administer agents developed from the compounds we've studied in a responsible fashion, in combination with other agents. This is routinely done in anti-tuberculosis therapy. Combination therapy prevents the emergence of resistance mm-hmm. if it is done responsibly
right.
and correctly.
So how soon do you think we'll have a working drug out of this?
What we have now are what we would refer to as lead compounds. These are compounds that exhibit broad-spectrum activity against many bacterial pathogens, including the tuberculosis bacterium. They have high potency against many bacterial pathogens, including the tuberculosis bacterium. One of them has no toxicity in animal tests, even when tested at high levels. For that compound, we now know exactly how it interacts with its target. We know which atoms of the compound interact with which atoms of the target. We are able, therefore, to predict changes to that compound, changes to its chemical mm-hmm. structure that would increase its interactions with the target, increase its binding affinity, increase its potency, and make it more effective. We have a means of synthesizing that compound. We currently are synthesizing analogs or derivatives of the compound intended to have higher optimized potency. Mm-hmm. Thus far, we've synthesized about a dozen, synthesized and tested them. All were active. We plan to greatly expand our program of synthesis and testing, and we hope that within a time frame of perhaps 1 year to perhaps 2 years to perhaps 3 years, we will have identified compounds that have significantly increased potency and optimized pharmacological properties in a position to enter into clinical trials.
With so many bacterial infections and these diseases of drug-resistant strains, I would imagine there's got to be a lot of money going into this field.
There are funds, but there is also a great need. The pharmaceutical industry has largely left this sector. The pharmaceutical industry during the 80s and 90s moved out of anti-infectives, and in particular out of antibacterial agents, seeking other areas of higher commercial promise. And in part because of that movement of the pharmaceutical industry away from this sector, the pipeline of new antibacterial compounds, genuinely new compounds from new chemical classes, like the compounds we've been discussing, is very, very dry.
So they've gone to the big gross-producing popular drugs like the statins and things like that.
The key difference between an anti-infective and a statin is that an anti-infective is given for a short period of time, or a relatively short period of time. A patient is ill, a patient takes the anti-infective compound, perhaps for 1 week, perhaps for 2 weeks for most infections, the patient is cured. In contrast with a statin, the patient goes on it and is on it for life. That gives a longer-term market, and the business side of the pharmaceutical industry has chosen, I think unwisely, to focus on that potential longer-term market and has tended to neglect the area of anti-infectives.
Well, if you come up with a good anti-infective, how could you then get it distributed if they're not in that business anymore?
The pharmaceutical industry understands that there is a need, understands that they can produce these compounds and market them and sell them at a profit. What they have left, what they've abandoned by and large, is the development stage. If one can identify compounds, lead compounds such as the ones we've been discussing with excellent antibiotic properties, if one can define their targets, their mechanisms, their structural bases of interaction, and then can use that information to optimize those compounds, bringing the development stage all the way up to clinical trials, then the pharmaceutical industry is willing to take over.
But in the meantime, you have to find your own money from someplace else.
That's right. So one finds resources from the funding agencies that support basic research. For example, the National Institutes of Health, which provided major funding for this work. The Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which provided major funding for this work. The Helmholtz Institute in Germany, which provided funding for this work. And one seeks additional resources from other basic science and transitional science and translational science funders, such as the Global Alliance for TB Drug Development.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ebright, for taking time to be with us, and good luck in finding that drug.
Thank you.
Richard Ebright is an investigator for the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and he's a professor in the Department of Chemistry at Rutgers University. We're going to take a short break and switch and come back and talk about an experiment that was done, well over 50 years ago. And the scientists have gone back and looked at the residue left over and, found a lot of stuff that was missed back then. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in the early days of our planet, how did lightning, swirling gases, erupting volcanoes give way to life, called what we used to call the chemical evolution of life? Well, over 50 years ago, Stanley Miller and Harold Urey conducted their famous spark flask experiment to find out. They hooked up an apparatus of tubes and flasks and wires. They shot electrical sparks through a mixture of gases thought to represent Earth's early atmosphere. And after about a week of all of this, they ended up with a number of different amino acids, the so-called building blocks of life, right there, right at the bottom of this giant flask after all this action had occurred. Well, fast forward, after Miller's death last year, a few of his old grad students, they dug out that box of samples from the original experiment. They analyzed them with superior 50 years later, lab technology available today, and they found a few surprises. Joining me now to talk about those results out this week in the journal Science is Antonio Lascano. He is distinguished professor on the origins and evolution of life in the science department at the National Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City, Mexico. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Lascano.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Whose idea was this?
Well, the idea came out in a very funny way because a couple of years ago, my friend and colleague Jeff Beda, who was also a very good friend of Stanley Miller, he and I were invited to give a lecture in Texas. And just before the lecture, we were comparing our images and our PowerPoint presentations. And then Jeff asked me, "What is this small vial that you have in that figure?" And I said, "Well, it's some of the original material that Stanley synthesized in 1953, and he gave it to me." Mm. And he was absolutely surprised, and I said, "Well, why don't we analyze it to see what's there?" And perhaps a couple of weeks later, I flew to La Jolla, and we went through the boxes, the boxes that Jeff has in his lab inherited from Stanley Miller, and we could identify without any problem the different samples that Stanley Miller had kept for over 50 years. very carefully annotated. It was quite easy, therefore, to compare them with his laboratory notebooks and then just go and press and actually do the analysis, doing, as you just mentioned, those things with the modern techniques, which are, of course, extremely powerful compared with what was available 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you found more stuff in that residue?
We were very surprised because part of the work was actually a reanalysis of the original samples, and we found 11 amino acids compared to the 5 that Stanley had reported. And then we decided to analyze another samples that were the outcome of what we like to call the volcanic experiment, a way in which Stanley Miller simulated the steam coming out for a volcanic cone during an eruption. And then, very much to our surprise, we found 22 different amino acids, many of them actually, not the ones you find in proteins, but that's quite fine because it shows that they are not the outcome of contamination by bacteria or the handling of the samples, and as well as 5 amines. They tend to be very volatile compounds.
Mm-hmm. And were they different kinds of material that was found originally?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, these compounds had not been synthesized, had not been reported originally mm-hmm. by Stanley Miller, and none of us really knows why he didn't publish the outcome of this volcanic experiment. I think he was so overwhelmed by the results of the classical experiment that was what was immediately what called the attention of himself, Professor Urey, and the media. But the other was a treasure in a Pandora box full of chemistry surprises.
Yeah, he didn't want to go through that again. So probably didn't want to go through the publicity and all that was inherent.
Well, he was a very shy person.
Yeah.
He was one of those scientists that was not craving to be under the spotlight. And he was a true academic, he was a true scholar, and he knew that a lot of attention was being paid to him. But I think that, as he once told me, the first experiment was a very hard act to follow.
I'll bet. So now looking at your experiments and his, and redoing that one over a little bit differently, what do these experiments tell us now about the origins of life and that primordial soup that may have existed?
Well, I think that the most significant conclusion that we can draw is that the chemistry of the primitive Earth was much more complex than we used to think. That will be, for me, the most important conclusion. The second conclusion is that you can actually proceed beyond the original experiment to actually look at what microenvironments may have provided. Here you have the simulation under laboratory condition of a volcanic eruption, and you see a wide range of different compounds that none of us will have ever imagined. But if you look at the other experiments that other people have done more recently, like George Cody and Bob Hazen at Carnegie, like Jack Chostak in Harvard, you see that when we look at microenvironments, whether simulating the environment of the primitive Earth with clays or minerals or inside liposomes, you actually see that the variety of compounds is huge. You see that the chemical reactions are very specific. And I think we should focus more now on these specific microenvironments that can enrich the primitive Earth in different molecules. And the third conclusion is that there is always a debate about whether the organics that accumulated in the primitive Earth were synthesized on the Earth or came from outside. And for me, the answer is that, too many cooks do not spoil the soup. They can actually enrich in it.
That's a great conclusion. Being in a very Catholic country like Mexico, do you encounter difficulties in researching the scientific origins of life, the chemical evolution?
Well, I've been teaching and researching this, the origin of life for over 30 years, 35 years, and the only time I had problems was with a couple of American preachers that came from those creationist groups in the United States to preach in Mexico. Catholics don't have a problem with evolution. We teach evolution. We teach Darwinian ideas in grammar school, fourth grade, five graders. They become acquainted with the idea of symbiosis in the sixth grade. That's also grammar school for our standards. And the origins of life and the evolution of life are taught all along junior high school, high school, and our students at the university have at least five courses on biological evolution. So the culture may be Catholic, but Catholics don't have a problem with evolution, and I think Americans don't either. I just think that the real problem is that the creationist groups are very vocal, but I think they are very far from representing, for instance, the very sophisticated media that you find in university or in academia.
Well, Dr. Lescano, I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Antonio Lescano is the Distinguished Professor on the Origins and Evolution of Life in the Science Department at the National Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City. Up next, a new opera based on the explosion of the atom bomb. Dr. Atomic, at precisely 5:30 a.m. on July 16, 1945, the first atomic bomb exploded in a soaring fireball lighting up the New Mexico desert sky. It was the beginning of the atomic age. And this week, an opera about the atom bomb and its creators opened at the Metropolitan Opera here in New York, called Dr. Atomic, a nickname for the father of the bomb, physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer. The opera's libretto is full of physics. And if you read along with it, you get the physics, and it's also full of poetry, because Oppenheimer was not only a scientific genius, he was a highly cultured man who spoke multiple languages. He savored literature, from Baudelaire's poetry to classic Hindu scriptures, and some of that makes it into the opera. And joining me now to talk about this enigmatic physicist and the race to the bomb and how it turns out, all of that. How do you turn all of that into an opera? And we're going to talk about that, because I saw the opera. It's really very, very terrific staging. I loved it. I saw it this week. Gerald Finley plays the title role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic, and he's here with us in our studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
And I'll say that again. I'm so embarrassed to have a great voice sitting next to me with my voice here in the studio. John Adams is the composer of Dr. Atomic. He also has a new memoir out now called Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. He joins us over the phone today. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Adams.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Penny Woolcock is the director of Dr. Atomic. She joins us over the phone from London. Welcome to the show, Ms. Woolcock.
Thank you very much.
John Adams, why an opera about an atomic bomb?
Well, I think that there's no more emphatic a symbol of what we are as Americans, both the good part of our, you know, invention and industry and imagination, and also, you know, our moral standing in the world than the atomic bomb. So opera is a very strange art form. You know, when we go into the theater and the lights go down, we are in a very unreal world. And part of that unreality allows us to address subjects and themes that other art forms are really sort of unable to do in quite the same way. So the atomic bomb seemed like an ideal story, ideal image, and of course Oppenheimer is a fantastically interesting character and much, much fun for me to set to music.
And Oppenheimer would be a good choice because he's got so many layers?
Well, of course, although I understand Oppenheimer only listened to classical music, but he didn't like opera, apparently. But, he was an immensely charismatic person. He was obviously profoundly reflective, thought about what he'd done. And, of course, as you mentioned, you know, his deep love of poetry, everything from Charles Baudelaire, the 19th century French poet, to the Bhagavad Gita, which Oppenheimer reportedly read in the original Sanskrit, to John Donne. These are great poets, and I was able to incorporate the actual poetry into the libretto.
Right. 1-800-989-8255 is our number, talking about Dr. Atomic. Gerald Finley, you had to be J. Robert Oppenheimer. How do you Do you have an interest in science? Was this something you'd like to do?
I studied science vigorously as a high school student, and actually was offered a scholarship to Canadian University for biochemistry, which I had to turn down because I also had a place at the Royal College of Music in London. And it wasn't a toss of a coin necessarily, but my life could have been very different.
Mm-hmm. And how did you study this part to be?
Well,
you got the hat right.
Thankfully, there are others that can costume me adequately. And it's of course so much resource material is available on this extraordinary man, and right the way from television interviews and film snippets, and obviously great resource books like Richard Rhodes' The Making of the Atomic Bomb. A number of biographies over the last few years have come out. That provided a fundamental intellectual approach for me. And then, of course, absorbing myself in the material that he himself was interested in, the Bhagavad Gita and the poetry of John Donne and Charles Baudelaire, as John Adams has just said. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get to know that very well. And then I also went to the Pecos Mountains in New Mexico just to get an idea of, and obviously Los Alamos, just to get a sense of geography and physical kind of relationship that he might have had. So I did what I could.
I noticed in the audience when I was there for the performance, I think saw Freeman Dyson, all these famous physicists.
We've had such a wonderful journey these last 3 or 4 years in meeting members of the scientific community who have come to the opera, who have made themselves available for fantastic symposia with us as artists, with their knowledge, obviously, of the specific sciences involved, and also then with the public kind of unifying us all. And that's been a wonderful journey.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the opera Dr. Atomic this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. With General Gerald Finley, John Adams, and Penny Wilcock, who is the director of Dr. Atomic. What was it like for you to direct something science-related, Penny?
Well, I hate to fall into the kind of stereotype gal here, but I have no scientific background whatsoever. And in fact, I went to a girls' school where we didn't even have a laboratory because the idea was that we were just being prepared for marriage, you know. I was offered Dr. Atomic about 2 years ago, but for a couple of years before that, I'd become very interested in the way that scientists think, because, I had a boyfriend whose father was a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, and he and I couldn't talk to him about his work, but one of the things that really kind of astonished me was that the way that scientists think is very similar to the way that artists think. Mm-hmm. And I had somehow imagined that scientists were very dry and started with a set of calculations and worked their way towards some kind of conclusion. But it became obvious that actually scientists, it's a kind of leap of the imagination. They have these hunches or intuitions or a problem or a question, and then you have a huge amount of work in order to see whether or not your hunch is going to pay off. And that's very similar to the way that we work as artists. So that was something that I'd become really thrilled by, actually. And also, I'd become very interested in Richard Feynman, who's not actually in the opera, but was at Los Alamos and was someone who, you know, could play the bongos and had won a competition in Rio in the carnival, you know, and would do a lot of calculations in strip bars. And that sort of mixture of the sacred and the profane seemed something that I could sort of, you know, relate to and become interested in.
And a tremendous practical joker.
Exactly, a tremendous practical joker. So I'd kind of read his accounts of being at Los Alamos before the notion of doing Dr. Atomic came up, and it was something that interested me because somehow scientists had stopped being these rather dry ivory tower creatures that I had imagined, and I realized that it was this community, very vibrant, cultured, radical people who were extremely thoughtful, in many cases very, very left-wing, you know, and completely not what I had imagined, you know, at the core of making the atomic bomb which was dropped on Hiroshima.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. We're talking about Dr. Atomic, which opened at the Met this week with Gerald Finley, who plays the role of J. Robert Oppenheimer. John Adams is the composer of Dr. Atomic and the author of a new memoir called Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. And Penny Wilcock is the director of Dr. Atomic. And we're going to take a short break. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Lots of lines open if you'd like to talk about science and the arts. And how do you stage an opera about something, you know, as seemingly difficult and as intricately physical as the atom bomb? Stage it very well. We'll come and talk about lots of those things and the interesting new things on stage the techniques they used in this opera. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking for the rest of the hour about Dr. Atomic, an opera about the atom bomb. Sitting next to me is General Finley, who plays the title role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic. And here's a little bit about what he was singing about on stage.
Batter my heart, three-personed God, that I may rise and stand, o'erthrow me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new.
Batter my heart three different ways. It sounded, Gerald, like he was under duress there.
Yeah, that's the moment. That's the moment in the opera when Oppenheimer's alone on stage, and the only other major thing on the stage in this production is the actual fat man atomic bomb.
The bomb. It really hovers overhead.
Yeah.
Visible almost all the time.
Yeah, and in that particular aria, it's the sonnet "Batter My Heart, Three Person God" by John Donne, and he's pleading effectively for some. For some solace from whatever deity he can search for to rescue his doomed soul.
Mm-hmm. John Adams, you did interweave all these different elements in there, taken from real-life writings.
Yeah, the libretto is an extraordinary libretto. We should mention that it's the creation of Peter Sellars, mm-hmm. who did the original production of Dr. Atomic in San Francisco, and with whom I've had a very fruitful, creative relationship that stretches back 25 years now to our first opera, Nixon in China. And in this case, Peter assembled all these quotes, as well as the little fragments of poetry, into a very, very meaningful and dramatically tense narrative, but it's amazing because when Edward Teller sings, he's actually singing Edward Teller's very words. A quote will come from Teller's memoirs, something that he remembered happening on that particular night before the bomb was exploded, and likewise passages from General Groves' biography, and I even ended up setting classified documents, top secret meetings that had been held, at the Defense Department and the Pentagon in 1945, and have been recently declassified. So it may sound like it's a bit of a cut and paste, harebrained collage, but in fact, it's not that at all. It really does flow very much like a really gripping drama, and in the middle of all these dialogues, the physicists arguing over the morality of the use of the bomb, or Teller and Oppenheimer fretting at the beginning in scene one over they can't get the fuses on the plutonium sphere to fire properly, and they're really afraid of a fizzle, and you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar experiment, even in World War II dollars, and the pressure on these guys was just enormous. Every day there was some frantic phone call from the White House saying, is it ready, is it ready, is it ready? So Oppenheimer, we heard, had literally lost so much weight, he was down under 100 pounds and smoking three packs a day. So, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for musical characterization of this constant state of tension.
Mm-hmm. Penny, the staging was just tremendous. I mean, the innovative use of multimedia. You know, on the way that the stage was, the setting sets were composed of almost like the walls of an apartment building or an office building laid bare, and the shades all brought down to be used as movie projection screens and rain and all kinds of things.
Yes, well, I come from a filmmaking background, so I was very interested in incorporating filmmaking techniques. But we also wanted the set to be very simple, because you have the desert, which is a huge challenge, you know, to recreate that on a stage, which is essentially a sort of square box, you know. And the desert was so beautiful, and Oppenheimer himself said that his two great loves were physics and the desert, and they were combined in the Manhattan Project. So a way of somehow conjuring up not just the dreadfulness of the project that they were involved in, but also the beauty of it and the excitement. And so we did want it to be a very beautiful set, because on this mesa, on the hill, you had a few thousand of the most brilliant young men, the average age is 25, the most brilliant young scientists in the world, working, as they thought initially, against the clock to get to the atomic bomb before Hitler did. And then the opera opens at the point at which Germany has surrendered, Japan is losing the war, and they know that they're nowhere near getting nuclear weapons. And there's this huge debate over the ethics of what they're doing. And I think that the opera has sort of tremendous resonance now, you know, because knowledge without wisdom is a very dreadful thing. And the things that they were talking about then and were really deep to their own hearts are just as gripping now, you know, both with weapons, but also obviously, you know, cloning and all these different things that are being worked on at the moment, which have tremendous kind of ethical and moral implications.
Mm-hmm. And the music captures that tension that's everywhere.
It's all about the music, really, and John is such a brilliant composer, because it's the first great 21st century opera, and you can hear in it the rhythms of the 20th and the early 21st century. So it's very exciting and very accessible, and I think it does bring something to life and makes us look again at perhaps something that we thought we had understood and digested.
Mm-hmm. Right at the beginning, John, the young scientist Robert Wilson reads a petition urging caution with the bomb. Do you think that scientists have to worry about the repercussions? Is that something you wanted to make, as Penny says, it's a universal worry still today?
Well, I'm often asked that question, and I think insofar as a scientist is a member of the human race, like the rest of us, that they ought to worry about, you know, the repercussions of their experiments. I know that there are some scientists who feel that they should be able to just do what they do and not have any concern with, you know, what other people utilize it for. And, I don't write these operas to take a political stand or to promote an agenda. For instance, you know, I've been living with this story for 8 years, you know, counting the 3 years that I read and researched and the 2 years writing it and then the years in the interim. And I to this day, am not even sure whether the use of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was right or not. I mean, I can see reasons for both sides of the debate. But what I'm trying to do in this opera is bring home the fact that that science is... it's this noble expression, you know, of what the human being can do, what makes us very special in terms of our thinking, our rationality, and our, you know, our control of matter. But at the same time, as Penny mentioned, you know, we're facing this with bioethics, and I also think particularly with the prolongation, the medical prolongation of life, that we can't shy away from the ethical issues that are inherent in every time we make a scientific advance.
Gerald, John talks about how many years he's been sitting with this baby, developing it. You've been involved playing Oppenheimer now for 3 years. Have you do you find yourself changing your interpretation of it over the years, or looking at it from different light?
Well, I mean, it's a hugely complex issue, and I've had to look at both sides. The opera itself is very wonderfully written so that the arguments are literally presented to Oppenheimer. Why don't we, you know, why don't we delay? Why don't we give a demonstration? Edward Teller, in the first very first scene, says, you know, we scientists, you know, are working on something so terrible that no amount of protesting or fiddling with politics will save our souls. So, you know, those are the first words from in the opera sung by a particular character, and that effectively is the challenge. And okay, we're more informed as material comes from that period, and all the different military ideas being pushed forward, the saving of American lives versus versus enemy lives. One life is one life, you know, all the way along. We're more informed, and yet the arguments are still very, very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's all I found, is the arguments are even tougher.
There was one scene in particular, well, a couple of times in that first act, where you have General Grove, who's in charge of the whole shebang, so to speak, admonishing the meteorologist to stop the rain. Stop this. There's a lightning storm going on, right? He's saying, you have the power to stop this. Make it happen or I'm going to hang you, he basically says. And yet then just a few moments later, he starts talking about, gee, how well my diet is working.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the I'm sure, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I think you must have had great delight in composing that particular little vignette. Of the chocolate diet.
What was your purpose in that? Was there a little comic relief here? Was that the real character?
Well, yeah. I mean, General Groves. I admit I do have a lot of fun with him. He's our basso, our buffo, and he's so wonderfully portrayed by our baritone Eric Owens. But, you know, he was a really brilliant guy, let's face it. You know, he took all these enormous engineering challenges, including building the Pentagon. And when Roosevelt named him to take over the Manhattan Project, the only thing people knew was that the nucleus could be split, the atom could be split. But they, you know, they all went and gathered in this remote spot on the Mesa in New Mexico, knowing nothing else, and the, you know, the fact that Groves was able to make it happen for Oppenheimer is an extraordinary thing. But you know, there's something funny about Groves screaming at the weatherman, but at the same time, I think it points out the fact that, you know, we think we're masters of the universe. You know, look here, we can build the atomic bomb, we can send a man to the moon, but we still can't control the weather, or we still can't control our diets. You know, so in certain senses, you know, we're still like infants in the cradle.
I think it also brings to life, you know, the way that in any situation, actually, I don't know how many of you have been, I'm sure most of us, to a funeral or have somebody who we love dying. And in the middle of all the great tragedy, there's often kind of very banal things or jokes or whatever. You know, nobody can really sustain that kind of tension. And I think that's one of the things that's really wonderful about the libretto, is that in the middle of all this sort of anxiety about whether the bomb will work or whether it'll ignite the Earth's atmosphere, and whether or not there'll be, you know, Truman will have a trump card to play with Stalin the next morning at Potsdam, there's somebody worrying about whether or not they're getting fat. And that's really human nature, isn't it? It's what we're like.
Yes, we've all seen that. We're talking about Dr. Atomic this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow here with Penny Wilcock, who's the director, John Adams is the composer, and Gerald Finley plays the role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic. That bomb, Penny, It looks so grotesque, so scary up there on that stage. Is that really what it looked like?
That's exactly what it looked like, and it was made by a man in England in his garage, and he absolutely copied the bomb to its last detail. So although, I mean, it's scary and grotesque in some ways, but in other ways it's kind of scarily kind of rinky-dink, really, with all these wires hanging out of it. And there are all these stories about how they were literally sort of stuffing Kleenex and using sellotape in order to keep things in their place. And one of the things that I'd read that really intrigued me was that they, when they had the bomb hanging there, they were worried that it might fall down and explode. And so they dragged 16 mattresses to pile up underneath it. This is somehow, you know, going to save them from the bomb exploding. And we had considered using that in the production. I thought, nobody will ever believe us or think we make it up, although we're, you know, trying to make fun of the scientists. But there was a sort of very kind of homemade aspect to it as well, which, you know, it's a rather frightening, I think.
Stuff falling off of it, it looks like. You know, yeah, right. It's like a scotch tape. John, last question. Do you think there might be more science operas in you?
You know, I think if you'd asked me the day after I put the final double bar on this after 2 years of work, I would have said, you're crazy. But after seeing, particularly after seeing Penny's production, which very much brings the science to the fore, I'm totally enchanted. And I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if science makes a major appearance in another stage work of mine.
All right. We're going to look forward to it. And I thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Gerald Finley plays the title role of J. Robert Oppenheimer in Dr. Atomic. He's here with us in New York. John Adams is the composer of Dr. Atomic and has a new memoir out now called Hallelujah Junction, Composing an American Life. He was joining us by phone today. And Penny Wilcock is the director of Dr. Atomic. I want to thank you, Penny, for taking time with us and staying up late to be on our show.
Thank you.
And good luck to all of you in the production.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have Science Friday's Pick of the Week there, and you can see more information about Dr. Atomic and how to go see it here in New York as it completes its run here. Also, you can send us email at sciencefriday.com or surf over to our website where we're podcasting and blogging and doing all kinds of creative things for you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.